This is a sad honor. In preparing this talk, I was thinking about the fact that I have given a talk at Joe's 60th, which was far too short a time ago, that's online, and many of you were here. And also, I wrote a blog post after he passed away, which many of you have read. And so I thought I would rather do something else. So if you're expecting me to say the same things, well, hopefully I'll entertain you at least in a different way. And also, of course, it's difficult to figure out what to say about Joe that's in any way something that we all don't know about him. Well, let me first just say I came across this photograph, which is poignant and relevant in several ways. Of course, it has a picture of Joe with Stephen Hawking, who also passed away this year. And this is a talk about Joe's work on gluons, and we have two of the world's experts on this subject, both in the room and on this slide, along with Paul Steinhardt, another very eminent physicist. I think comparison to all the other speakers so far, and probably throughout the conference, I actually knew Joe the least. I met him in 1991-92 when I was still a grad student. I came down from Stanford just to drop in and meet people, and I had I met him briefly, and there was some question which I'd been wondering about. I'd been asking a bunch of people about it, something relevant for my thesis, and 10 people I'd asked had sort of deferred, and Joe immediately answered it without even thinking. So I already knew right off the bat that this was going to be an interesting guy to talk to. And then over the years, as I was a postdoc, and again would come here for short visits, I had many great conversations with him. In 1996, I had to make the difficult decision about my second postdoc, and I turned down an opportunity to come here to the KITP. And well, you know, those are the decisions you have to make in life, but you can't be everywhere at once. But I have often wondered what it would have been like to be here at that time. But fortunately for me, I came to visit in 1999 for a workshop, and very quickly found a problem I was very excited about and managed to convince Joe that it was something he should be excited about too. And that began a very a wonderful collaboration which lasted over a number of years and a number of papers, and also involved a stint here running a workshop and a conference on the subjects that were of interest to us. I think the reason our collaboration worked as well as it did is that we had a lot of commonality in terms of what interested us and common style, and particularly we were interested in universal questions in both field theory and string theory that were not of interest to most people, with exceptions, of course, including some of the people in this room. But on the other hand, we were very rarely in the same place at the same time. So I think probably the total amount of time I spent with Joe was at most 6 months. A couple months here, a couple months there, and a few days strung around. So I don't have all these good stories, and I'm not going to try to tell them about Joe as a person, other than, of course, what a wonderful man he was. But I want to give you a sense for how much fun it was to work with Joe, both to remind those who had that experience and to share with those who did not. So it's a mixed audience, and I want to express the collaboration in some simple words, for starters. So first of all, it was fun. It was an enormous amount of fun. It was just being around Joe and talking about physics with Joe and discovering things with Joe was a blast. Another thing that was very common in this collaboration was awe. This was mostly me towards him. I have never seen anything like it in a collaboration of my own, to just see someone whose technical capabilities were just off the charts. And I'll say a little bit about that later. And third of all, we were working on physics that was just itself intrinsically fantastic. And so we were having a wonderful time just looking at what nature and mathematics are capable of. This is a talk about glue. Why glue? Well, the usual boilerplate we tell everybody out in the world is that you boil down matter, you eventually get to protons and neutrons, and they're made from quarks. But of course, we know this is really not true. In a sense, at least, protons and neutrons are mainly made from gluons, and the quarks are there just to, keep things stable. And in general, of course, hadrons of all types are made from gluons. The quarks and the details are in the details, but it's the gluons that matter. You can argue with me later if you want, but I mean, I think this is this is really a fundamental point, and it's because, of course, hadrons in any theory that have hadrons, it's the gluons that are always along for the ride. So studying gluons is a relevant thing to be doing. And the opportunity to do that in a new way came in 1997 when a number of people in the room, and then eventually Maldacena, put a few things together using the D-brains that Joe had put on the table for us. And that was to realize that every field theory in 3 plus 1 dimensions, this is now stated in sort of a modern way, every 3 plus 1 dimensional field theory can be rewritten as a 10-dimensional string theory with various asterisks. And what's neat is that there are various universal things about gravity and more generally gravity in string theory, which I've listed on the right-hand side, and those correspond to universal things in gauge theories, namely the gluons, their energy momentum tensor, and various operators associated with them that were mentioned, in fact, in a talk earlier today by David Simmons-Stephen. And more to the point with respect to the real world, if the field theory is confining, then there are additional universal things which map very closely, namely the electrically confined flux tubes that are the definition of confinement in this context, and hadrons that are made entirely from gluons, or dominantly from gluons, namely the glue balls, and their higher spin partners, which are related to the universal graviton and its rigid trajectory in string theory. So when you see all these wonderful universal things, obviously we as a community, and Joe and I as individuals, saw this as a wonderful opportunity that even though the tractable cases, the cases you can really calculate in using this technology that Juan Maldacena introduced, do not include the strong nuclear force of the real world. Nevertheless, the gluons are something universal, and so maybe by looking at tractable cases, you can learn something universal about gluons and what they do that will be relevant, at least conceptually, in the real world. And so this is what led Joe and I to embark on a project that essentially had one step after another, four papers, the last one with Rich Brower and Chung-Yi Tan. All of them started with visits here, which got Joe and I talking. And obviously, I don't have time to say much about any of them. If I had a long talk, I would talk about the last one, which I think is one in which we really made some connection with things that are important to know about the real world. But instead, I'll say a few words about the first one, because for those of you who aren't experts, the pictures are cool. Not pictures of Joe, unfortunately. I have no pictures of Joe. I just borrow them from the internet. So if you're not an expert, you're not going to follow this at all. Just enjoy the pictures. Sit back. It's a movie. What I'm going to do, let's see. What Maldacena's correspondence allowed us to do was take physics that we wanted to know about, physics in free spatial dimensions, which I'll put in this corner, and express them in a new vision using 10-dimensional string theory, which on the face of it should be completely different, and yet has the same physics. And here, what's drawn this direction is ordinary space that we're familiar with. These other directions are extra dimensions that we don't have to really care about unless we're experts. And what Maldacena told us was that we can use Joe's D-brains, stretched out in space, to describe field theories, theories with gluons. And in N equals 1 star, the theory that Joe and I were interested in, you can get confinement of flux by something known as the Myers effect, which takes the D3 brains and puffs them up into a sphere, which is an NS5 brain with some 3-brain charge. So that was pretty cool. We sort of knew this was right on day one. This had to be the way that confinement is represented in this theory. But now there's a problem. This is a 2-dimensional sphere of a complicated brain sitting inside a complicated curved space, which has 6 extra dimensions and is already curved. And how can you actually calculate the properties of this object? And most of us wouldn't know how to do it. Oh, I will mention the way you can see this is confining is that if you hang a string down, it has no place to end, but it will bind to this NS5 brain and make a flux tube, which is what's supposed to happen in a confining theory. So we knew this was the right answer, but the problem is how do you show it? You have to actually calculate what the brains do and calculate the back-reactive metric, which is a very hard problem, at least on the face of it. And so the picture that we knew had to be true is that somehow you start with a bunch of D3 brains, which are the ones that Juan Maldacena gave us to start with, and they puff up into a sphere with free brains scattered in it. Well, if you want to understand an NS brain with D brain charge, you should start with a D brain, because D brains are easier. That's what Joe did for us. He took hard problems, he made them simple. And so this is a simpler problem. It is still not an easy problem. How do you calculate the properties of this object and their back reaction on the metric? And so Joe, I'll tell you the punchline, figured out over a period of months. The trick is move the D3 brains first. Start with n equals 4 Young Mills, move the D3 brains into the sphere that you know they're going to end up in, and then treat the D5 brain as a perturbation on that. And when you do that, something magic happens. The metric of the D3 brains, which is complicated, cancels out. And you just do a calculation which is the same as doing a probe calculation. And that probe calculation is a lot easier than the calculation you thought you were going to have to do. It's still hard. It took Joe months to do this probe calculation. So you can imagine what it would have been like if I was trying to do this alone. Well, I wouldn't have a job. So Joe, in doing this, put together a string of technical tricks, guesses, clever ideas, and hard calculations that, if you look at the paper, stretch over 20 dense pages. And it's an absolute tour de force of calculation, which I suggest that those of you who are teaching string theory should give as your final project in your string theory classes. And that is how you will discover the next Joe Polchinski. Domain walls are also fun. Pretty pictures again, for those of you who aren't experts. The point is that this theory has different vacua. It can be confining, it can be completely Higgs, it has oblique confinement, different ways that the world can be. And so you can imagine, if that's the case, that half the world could be one way, half the world could be another way, and there's got to be some sort of separation between them. And these so-called domain walls were well known in field theory. In fact, it was even known that these D-brains, by this time it was already known that these these domain walls are actually D-brains, because flux tubes can end on them, as was pointed out in 97. So Joe and I knew a lot about these walls had to exist. We knew that confinement was represented by this type of brain. We knew that oblique confinement should be represented by that type of brain. There had to be some other domain wall between them. It had to be a D-brain, so you didn't need, you might need a PhD in physics, but you didn't need to be Joe to guess that what's happening is the domain wall in a situation like this is represented in string theory as a junction of 5 brains. Okay, that's fine. Nice picture. How do you calculate that? This particular wall, we know its tension. How do you calculate that in this theory? Well, it doesn't look so bad until you remember that, well, first of all, the radii of these two brains is not exactly the same. The orientation of these two spheres that I've drawn as though they're parallel is not the same. They're tilted differently in the extra 6 dimensions. The curved geometry that we're working with is very complicated. There's almost no symmetries in it. Was this a problem for Joe? No. It took him a week. It's a beautiful little bit of theoretical physics. It takes about 3 pages, a lot of clever ideas, and in the end, there's a calculation that reproduces the correct tension of this and other domain walls. So, you know, it was a lot of fun drawing these pictures, and then it was a lot of awe watching Joe produce these results, which I could barely keep up with. Even if I'd been an expert, and I wasn't, I think it would have been hard to do all the things that Joe did. I really don't think very many people understood brains well enough. They didn't know how to do the calculations in curved spaces the way Joe did. They didn't have the insight to just see what didn't matter and what tricks to use. It's very rare to find someone who with that level of capability. And it was an absolute privilege on my part to be able to watch this in action, to watch a genius do his thing. And I'll finish just by telling you one more thing about this theory, which I think is particularly nice, because in this theory, I believe for the first time, certainly one of the first times, but I believe it may be the first time, and I'm not even sure how many others there have been, there is a finite mass baryon, a proton-like object, whose mass can be calculated. It's a dynamical object. The theory is fully 4-dimensional. And here we have a theory with a proton-like object that you can calculate. So, and it's fun. So watch the pictures for those of you just doing so. Okay, so we go back to the vacuum in which electric flux is confined, the one that is like the real world in some ways. And but I'm starting with a world that doesn't have any quarks, because that's the one that Juan first wrote down. And in 1998, it was pointed out that if you want to have some sort of object which can bind, let's say, quark-like objects together, you need a baryon vertex. That baryon vertex is described as a D5 brain in Juan's original picture. But in this theory, that D5 brain is unstable. It will collapse. A collapsing D5 brain, which corresponds to the fact that your baryon vertex will grow up to a certain point. So watch the pictures. Here's what happens. The thing starts to collapse, and it keeps collapsing, and it hits the NS5 brain, and oh, isn't this cool? There's a brain crossing. A D3 brain is generated in the brain crossing, the D5 brain disappears, and here's your baryon vertex. It's a D3 brain in the shape of a ball inside the sphere of the NS5 brain. Now that's pretty cool, but that's not a baryon yet. This is just the thing which can connect three flux tubes. How do you make a baryon? Well, here's another cool thing. N equals one star, this particular theory, has lots and lots and lots of different vacua. In fact, this is part of what got Joe thinking with Raphael Busso about having a discrete room. It has an exponentially large number of vacua, and some of those vacua have not only confinement, but also breaking of the gauge group first. So you take the gauge group, you break it a little bit, and then the rest of it confines, and you're left with objects that connect the two, which are quark-like. They're in the fundamental representation of the gauge group. And they're confined. There's no place for them to end here, so they can't exist on their own, but nothing stops you from attaching them to your D3 brain that makes the baryon vertex, and there you go. That's a baryon. Finite mass. You could calculate it if you wanted to. So the lesson here, I think, of this and all the other talks is that even though Joe himself said he didn't want to be remembered as the D-brain guy, the ubiquity of D-brains in field theory and string theory essentially makes that impossible. And it's only because Joe himself was in a way modest and didn't even himself wrap his head around just what he had done for this field. The fact that you cannot today teach either quantum field theory or string theory without putting D-brains in front of the students. I think I lost the very end of what I was going to say, but the importance of Joe's work cannot be understated in this field today, and I think that that's a permanent situation in this field. And our collaboration allowed us to look at a number of universal aspects of gauge theory, which I've emphasized just a tiny bit of, and they always required some profound technical insight as well as some conceptual advances. I could help with the conceptual stuff, but clearly the technical stuff was spectacular, and that was true in paper after paper. And it allowed us to find new ways of thinking about phenomena which do matter to physics, not just to mathematical physics, but to real physics, including, for example, new pictures of protons. So I just want to leave it all with a thank you to Joe, as well as to the institution that he spent his majority of his career in, because that was essential for my career and essential, I think, for the field. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Matt. Time is a little bit short, but if there's a question. Okay, let's thank Matt again.